Chapter 8 – Election of Nectarius to the See of Constantinople, High's Birthplace and Education. A certain man of Tarsus in Cilicia, of the illustrious order of Senator, was at this period residing at Constantinople. 3. Being about to return to his own country, he called upon Diodorus, bishop of Tarsus, to inquire whether he had any letters to send by him. Diodorus was fully intent upon the ordination, which was the subject then engrossing universal attention of the men. He had no sooner seen Nectarius than he considered him worthy of the bishopric, and straightway determined this in his own mind as he reflected on the venerable age of the man, his form so befitting a priest, and the suavity of his manners. He conducted him, as if upon some other business, to the bishop of Antioch, and requested him to use his influence to procure this election. The bishop of Antioch derided this request, for the names of the most eminent men had already been proposed for consideration. He, however, called Nectarius to him, and desired him to remain for a short time with him. Some time after, the emperor commanded the priests to draw up a list of the names of those whom they thought worthy of the ordination, reserving to himself the right of choosing any one of those whose names were thus submitted to him. All the bishops complied with this mandate, and, among the others, the bishop of Antioch wrote down the names of those whom he proposed as candidates for the bishopric, and, at the end of his list, from consideration for Diodorus, he inserted the name of Nectarius. The emperor read the list of those inscribed and stopped at the name of Nectarius at the end of the document, on which he placed his finger, and seemed for some time lost in reflection, ran it up to the beginning, and again went through the whole, and chose Nectarius. This nomination excited great astonishment, and all the people were anxious to ascertain who Nectarius was, his manner of life, and birthplace. When they heard that he had not been initiated, their amazement was increased at the decision of the emperor. I believe that Diodorus himself was not aware that Nectarius had not been baptized, for, had he been acquainted with this fact, he would not have ventured to give his vote for the priesthood to one uninitiated. It appears reasonable to suppose that on perceiving that Nectarius was of advanced age, he took it for granted that he had been initiated long previously. But these events did not take place without the interposition of God. For when the emperor was informed that Nectarius had not been initiated, he remained of the same opinion, although opposed by many priests. When at last consent had been given to the imperial mandate, Nectarius was initiated, and while yet clad in his initiatory robes, was proclaimed bishop of Constantinople by the unanimous voice of the synod. Many have conjectured that the emperor was led to make this election by a divine revelation. I shall not decide whether this conjecture be true or false, but I feel convinced, when I reflect on the extraordinary circumstances attending this ordination, that the events were not brought about without the divine strength, and that God led this mild and virtuous and excellent man into the priesthood. Such are the details which I have been able to ascertain concerning the ordination of Nectarius. Chapter 9 – Decrees of the Second General Council. Maximus, the cynical philosopher. After these transactions, Nectarius and the other priests assembled together, 1, and decreed that the faith established by the Council of Nicaea should remain dominant, and that all heresies should be condemned, that the churches everywhere should be governed according to the ancient canons, that each bishop should remain in his own church, and not go elsewhere under any light pretext, or, without invitation, perform ordinations in which he had no right to interfere, as had frequently been the case in the Catholic Church during the times of persecution. They likewise decreed that the affairs of each church should be subjected to the investigation and control of a council of the province, and that the bishop of Constantinople should rank next in point of precedence to the bishop of Rome, as occupying the see of New Rome, for Constantinople was not only already favored with this appellation, but was also in the enjoyment of many privileges, such as a senate of its own, and the division of the citizens into ranks and orders. It was also governed by its own magistrates, and possessed contracts, laws, and immunities in equal degree with those of Rome in Italy. The council also decreed that Maximus had not been nor was now a bishop, and that those individuals whom he had ordained were not of the clergy, and that all that had been done by him, or in his name, was null and void. Maximus was a native of Alexandria, and, by profession, a cynical philosopher. He was zealously attached to the Nicene doctrines, and had been secretly ordained bishop of Constantinople by bishops who had assembled in that city from Egypt. Such were the decrees of the council. They were confirmed by the emperor, who enacted, too, that the faith established at Nicaea should be dominant, and that the churches everywhere should be placed in the hands of those who acknowledged one and the same Godhead in the hypostases of three persons of equal honor and of equal power, namely, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. To designate them still more precisely, the emperor declared that he referred to those who held communion with Nectarius, at Constantinople, and with Timothy, bishop of Alexandria, in Egypt, in the churches of the East with Diodorus, bishop of Tarsus, and in Syria with Pelagius, bishop of Laodicea, and in Asia with Amphilochius, president of the churches in Iconium, to those in the cities by the Pontus, from Bithynia to Armenia, who held communion with Heladius, bishop of the church of Caesarea in Cappadocia, with Gregory, bishop of Nyssa, and with Atrinus, bishop of Mulitene, and to the cities of Thrace and Scythia, who held communion with Terentius, bishop of Tomi, and with Martyrius, bishop of Marcianopolis. The emperor was personally acquainted with all these bishops, and had ascertained that they governed their respective churches wisely and piously. After these transactions, the council was dissolved, and each of the bishops returned homewards. Chapter 10 – Concerning Martyrius of Cilicia, translation of the remains of Saint Paul the Confessor, and of Malchus, bishop of Antioch. Nectarius made himself acquainted with the routine of sacerdotal ceremonies under the instruction of Syriacus, 1, bishop of Adana, whom he had requested Diodorus, bishop of Tarsus, to leave with him for a short period. Nectarius also retained several other Cilicians with him, amongst whom was Martyrius, his physician, who had been a witness of the irregularities of his youth. Nectarius was desirous of ordaining him deacon, but Martyrius refused the honor under the plea of his own unworthiness of such a divine service, and called upon Nectarius himself to witness as to the course of his past life. To this Nectarius replied as follows: "Although I am now a priest, do you not know that my past career was a more guilty one than yours, inasmuch as you were but an instrument in my numerous profligacies? But you, O blessed one," replied Martyrius, "were cleansed by baptism, and were then accounted worthy of the priesthood. Both these ordinances are appointed by the divine law for purification from sin, and it seems to me that you now differ in no respect from a newborn infant. But I long ago received holy baptism, and have since continued in the same abusive course." It was under this plea that he excused himself from receiving ordination, and I commend the man for his refusal, and therefore would give him a part in my history. The Emperor Theodosius, on being informed of various events connected with Paul, too, formerly bishop of Constantinople, caused his body to be removed to the church erected by Macedonius, his enemy, and buried there. This temple is a spacious and most distinguished edifice, and is still named after Paul. Hence many persons who are ignorant of the facts of the case, particularly women and the mass of the people, imagine that Paul, the apostle, is interred therein. The remains of Malchus were at the same time conveyed to Antioch, and deposited near the tomb of Babylas the martyr. It is said that through every public way, by the command of the emperor, the relics were received within the walls in every city, contrary to Roman custom, and were honored with singing of psalms antiphonally in such places, until they were transferred to Antioch. Chapter 11 – Ordination of Flavian as bishop of Antioch, and subsequent occurrences on account of the oath. After the pompous interment of the remains of Malchus, Flavian was ordained in his stead, and that, too, in direct violation of the oath he had taken. 3. For Paulinus was still alive. This gave rise to fresh troubles in the church of Antioch. Many persons refused to maintain communion with Flavian, and held their church apart with Paulinus. Even the priests differed among themselves on this subject. The Egyptians, Arabians, and Cypriots were indignant at the injustice that had been manifested towards Paulinus. On the other hand, the Syrians, the Palestinians, the Phoenicians, and the greater part of Armenia, Cappadocia, Galatia, and Pontus, sided with Flavian. The Bishop of Rome, and all the Western priests, regarded the conduct of Flavian with the utmost displeasure. They addressed the customary epistles, called synodical, to Paulinus as bishop of Antioch, and took no notice of Flavian. They also withdrew from communion with Diodorus, bishop of Tarsus, and Acacius, bishop of Berea, because they had ordained Flavian. 4. To take further cognizance of the affair, the Western bishops and the emperor Gratian wrote to the bishops of the East, and summoned them to attend the council in the West. Chapter 12. Project of Theodosius to unify all the heresies. The propositions made by Agelius and Sisenius. The novations, at another synod. The emperor received those only who represent consubstantiality, those who held a different view he ejected from the churches. Although all the houses of prayer were at this period in the possession of the Catholic Church, many troubles occurred in various parts of the empire, instigated by the Arians. 1. The Emperor Theodosius, therefore, soon after the council above mentioned, again summoned together the presidents of the sects which were flourishing, in order that they might either bring others to their own state of conviction on disputed topics, or be convinced themselves, for he imagined that all would be brought to oneness of opinion, if a free discussion were entered into, concerning ambiguous points of doctrine. The council, therefore, was convened. This occurred in the year of the second consulate of Maroboards, and the first of Saturninus, and at the same period that Arcadius was associated with his father in the government of the empire. Theodosius sent for Nectarius, consulted with him concerning the coming synod, and commanded him to introduce the discussion of all questions which had given rise to heresies, so that the church of the believers in Christ might be one, and might agree on the doctrine according to which piety ought to be observed. When Nectarius returned home, feeling anxious about the affair confided to him, he made known the mandate of the emperor to Agelius, the president of the Church of the Novatians, who held the same religious sentiments as himself. Agelius proved the virtue of his life by works, but was unaccustomed to the finesse and deception of words. He therefore proposed as a substitute, one of his readers, by name Sisenius, who afterwards succeeded him as bishop, a man who could see what was practical, and could debate, if that were necessary. Sisenius possessed powers of intellect and of expression, he had an accurate knowledge of the interpretation of the Holy Scriptures, and was well acquainted with profane and with ecclesiastical literature. He proposed that all disputation with the heterodox, as being a fruitful source of contention and war, should be avoided, but recommended that inquiries should rather be instituted, as to whether the heretics admitted the testimony of the expositors and teachers of the sacred words, who lived before the church was rent in division. If they reject the testimony of these great men, said he, they will be condemned by their own followers, but if they admit their authority as being adequate to resolve ambiguous points of doctrine, we will produce their books. For Sisenius was well aware that, as the ancients recognized the Son to be eternal like the Father, they had never presumed to assert that he had had an origin from some beginning. This suggestion received the approbation of Nectarius, and afterwards of the emperor, and investigations were set on foot as to the opinions entertained by heretics concerning the ancient interpreters of Scripture. As it was found that the heretics professed to hold these early writers in great admiration, the emperor asked them openly whether they would defer to the authority of the aforesaid on controverted topics, and test their own doctrines by the sentiments propounded in those works. This proposition excited great contention among the leaders of the various heretical sects, for they did not all hold the same view about the books of the ancients. The emperor knew that they were convicted by the debates over their own words alone, and withdrew the proposition. He blamed them for their opinion, and commanded each party to draw up a written exposition of its own creed. On the day appointed for the presentation of these documents, Nectarius and Agelius appeared at the palace, as representatives of those who maintain the consubstantiality of the Holy Trinity. Demophilus, the Arian president, came forward as the deputy of the Arians, Eunomius represented the Eunomians, and Eleusius, bishop of Cyzicus, appeared for the sectarians denominated Macedonians. The emperor, after receiving their formularies, expressed himself in favor of that one alone in which consubstantiality of the Trinity was recognized, and destroyed the others. The interests of the Novatians were not affected by this transaction, for they held the same doctrines as the Catholic Church concerning the divine nature. The members of the other sects were indignant with the priests for having entered into unwise disputations in the presence of the emperor. Many renounced their former opinions, and embraced the authorized form of religion. The emperor enacted a law, prohibiting heretics from holding churches, from giving public instructions in the faith, and from conferring ordination on bishops or others. 2. Some of the heterodox were expelled from the cities and villages, while others were disgraced and deprived of the privileges enjoyed by other subjects of the empire. Great as were the punishments adjudged by the laws against heretics, they were not always carried into execution, for the emperor had no desire to persecute his subjects. He only desired to enforce uniformity of view about God through the medium of intimidation. Those who voluntarily renounced heretical opinions received commendation from him. Chapter 13-Maximus the Tyrant. Concerning the occurrences between the empresses Justina and Saint Ambrose, the emperor Gratian was killed by guile. Valentinian and Hi's mother fled to Theodosius in Thessalonica. As the emperor Gratian was at this period occupied with a war against the Alemanni. 1. Maximus quitted Britain, with the design of usurping the imperial power. Valentinian was then residing in Italy, but as he was a minor, the affairs of state were transacted by Probus, a praetorian prefect, who had formerly been consul. Justina, the mother of the emperor, having espoused the Arian heresy, persecuted Ambrose, bishop of Milan, and disquieted the churches by her efforts to introduce alterations in the Nicene doctrines, and to obtain the predominance of the form of belief set forth at Ariminum. She was incensed against Ambrose because he strenuously opposed her attempts at innovation, and she represented to her son that he had insulted her. Valentinian believed this calumny, and, determined to avenge the supposed wrongs of his mother, he sent a party of soldiers against the church. On their reaching the temple, they forced their way into the interior, arrested Ambrose, and were about to lead him into exile at that very moment, when the people assembled in crowds at the church, and evinced a resolution to die rather than submit to the banishment of their priest. Justina was still further incensed at this occurrence, and with a view of enforcing her project by law, she sent for Minervilus, to one of the legal secretaries, and commanded him to draw up, as quickly as possible, an edict confirmatory of the decrees of Ariminum. Minervilus, being firmly attached to the Catholic Church, refused to write the document, and the empress tried to bribe him by promises of greater honors. He still, however, refused compliance, and, tearing off his belt, he threw it at the feet of Justina, and declared that he would neither retain his present office, nor accept of promotion, as the reward of impiety. As he remained firm in his refusal, others were entrusted with the compilation of the law. By this law, all who conformed to the doctrines set forth at Ariminum and ratified at Constantinople were exhorted to convene boldly, and it was enacted that death should be the punishment of those who should hinder or be running counter to this law of the emperor. While the mother of the emperor was planning the means of carrying this cruel law into execution, intelligence was brought of the murder of Gratian, through the treachery of Andragathius, the general of Maximus. Andragathius obtained possession of the imperial chariot, and sent word to the emperor that his consort was traveling towards his camp. Gratian, who was but recently married and youthful, as well as passionately attached to his wife, hastened incautiously across the river, and in his anxiety to meet her fell without forethought into the hands of Andragathius. He was seized, and, in a little while, put to death. He was in the 24th year of his age, and had reigned 15 years. This calamity quieted Justina's wrath against Ambrose, Maximus, in the meantime, raised a large army of Britons, neighboring Gauls, Celts, and other nations, and marched into Italy. The pretext which he advanced for this measure was that he desired to prevent the introduction of innovations in the ancient form of religion and of ecclesiastical order, but he was in reality actuated by the desire of dispelling any suspicion that might have been excited as to his aspirations after tyranny. He was watching and intriguing for the imperial rule in such a way that it might appear as if he had acquired the Roman government by law, and not by force. Valentinian was compelled by the exigencies of the times to recognize the symbols of his rule, but soon after, in fear of suffering, fled with his mother Justina, and Probus, the Praetorian prefect in Italy, to Thessalonica. Chapter 14 – Birth of Honorius. Theodosius leaves Arcadius at Constantinople, and proceeds to Italy. Succession of the Novatian and other patriarchs. Audacity of the Arians. Theodosius, after destroying the tyrant, celebrates a magnificent triumph in Rome. While Theodosius was making preparations for a war against Maximus, his son Honorius was born. 3. On the completion of these warlike preparations, he left his son Arcadius to govern at Constantinople, and proceeded to Thessalonica, where he received Valentinian. He refused either to dismiss openly, or to give audience to the embassy sent by Maximus, but continued his journey at the head of his troops towards Italy. About this period, Agellius, bishop of the Novatians at Constantinople, feeling his end approaching, nominated Sicinius, one of the presbyters of his church, as his successor. The people, however, murmured that the preference had not rather been given to Marcin, who was noted on account of his piety, and Agellius therefore ordained him, and addressed the people who were assembled in the church in the following words: "After me you shall have Marcellan for your bishop, and after him, Sicinius." Agellius died soon after he had uttered these words. He had governed his church 40 years with the greatest approbation from his own heretical party, and some assert that during the times of pagan persecution, he had openly confessed the name of Christ. Not long after Timothy and Cyril died, Theophilus succeeded to the See of Alexandria, and John to that of Jerusalem. Damophilus, leader of the Arians at Constantinople, likewise died and was succeeded by Marinus of Thrace, but he was superseded by Dorotheus, who soon after arrived from Antioch in Syria, and who was considered by his sect to be better qualified for the office than Marinus. Theodosius, having in the meantime entered Italy, various conflicting reports were spread as to the success of his arms. It was rumored among the Arians that the greater part of his army had been cut to pieces in battle, and that he himself had been captured by the tyrant, and assuming this report to be true, these sectarians became bold and ran to the house of Nectarius and set it on fire, from indignation at the power which the bishop had obtained over the churches. The emperor, however, carried out his purpose in the war, for the soldiers of Maximus, impelled by fear of the preparations against them, or treachery, seized and slew the tyrant. Andragathius, the murderer of Gratian, no sooner heard of the death of Maximus than he leapt into the river with his armor, and perished. The war having been thus terminated, and the death of Gratian avenged, Theodosius, accompanied by Valentinian, celebrated a triumph in Rome, and restored order in the churches of Italy, for the Empress Justina was dead.